at the commencement of this creation. We are told in the scripture, having created men, the gods and the rest of the universe, the Lord commanded with sacrifice for thy companion, you go for your companion, you go forth in the world. By sacrifice, you foster yourselves. Sacrifice is one of the great fundamental truths of life in this creation, whose fuller significance becomes patent to us in spiritual life. Indeed, sacrifice as a truth obtains on every level of creation. It is nature's means of rebuilding the unity of life, which has been broken up into fragments in the course of involution. Sacrifice, it is an interchange, a giving up of oneself to another, bridging the gulf that obtains normally between any two in creation. It is understood that at the lower levels of creation, sacrifice is more or less imposed. It is not voluntary. It is a compulsion by nature, by which each creature shares its life with the others. At the human level, sacrifice, the principle of sacrifice, is a corrective to the developing ego, which tends to regard its temporary division and separativity as the sole sufficing truth of life. Having fragmented into small bits at the material level, on its return journey, creative nature brings in the law of interchange, of mutual self-giving, mutual help. At first, this working is disguised under whatever please, mental or vital. Men may think that they are associating themselves for their own safety, giving something of themselves to others in order to assure their own self-existence. But the truth is otherwise. No man can live by himself. There is nothing, in fact, that belongs to one. The physical body is derived from the universal matter. The very breath draws from the universal force of life. The bit of mind that is active in man is a fragment projected from the universal mind ocean. His very soul is a speck of the vast spirit manifest in the universe. This being the truth, it is inevitable that each individual has to associate himself with the others if he is to forge a line of progress. Whether he consciously wills it or not, an incessant interchange Goswami, he draws upon the universal life energies, physical nourishment, thought forces that are abroad, and he radiates constantly his own physical aura, his vital energies, his thought substance. He pours them out. Rather, they are poured out, whether he is aware of it or not, in the universe. Yoga seizes upon this central truth of sacrifice, of interchange, at the origin of creation. You will recall, in one of our earlier talks, we had described how, in response to the call of nature, of the soul which had lost itself in the depths of inconscience, the divine light, the supreme grace, rapidly came down, made a sacrifice of itself, and took its lodging in matter, in the darkness of matter, in order to reclaim the soul. Here too, it is a descent of the divine consciousness invoked by some self-giving on the part of the soul which surrendered itself to its mercy. The divine responds to the human call, and this readiness of the divine to make a holocaust of himself is at the bottom of the doctrine of redemption. Man can be saved, the world can be saved, because the Creator is ever ready to sacrifice himself for that purpose. The sacrifice goes on at all levels. The sacrifice between man and God, man sacrificing himself, all that he cherishes, all that he has and contains, the divine sacrificing its peace, its absoluteness, its supreme consciousness, taking on itself the cloak of ignorance in order to help man to rise above the belt of ignorance. It is this truth which has to be kept in mind. When one sacrifices oneself, apparently, it may look, one gives to the family, to the country, to humanity. But in fact, whatever the ignorant motive on the surface, he who receives is the Lord, is the Divine. The Divine dwells in each form, in each creature, and once a true sacrifice is made in a spirit of consecration, it is the divine in the objective, it is the divine in the object of sacrifice that responds and receives the sacrifice. As men approach, so I receive them. That's the master word of the Gita. The giving, the self-giving, which is the key of sacrifice, may be in any form, may be a glass of water, a petal of flower, a lotus, a thought, an emotion. In whatever form the movement of self-giving takes place, the receiver, the divine dweller, receives it with due sacredness. The point is, a spiritual seeker should become more and more conscious of this interchange of this self-giving. If in an ignorant man it is forced on him by nature, by circumstances, it behoves the awakened man to become conscious of it, to add significance to it, to become fully aware of it, and do it consciously. This, after all, is the meaning of that historic legend in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. They were the days when kings were sages, and sages ruled over the hearts of men. There was King Janaka, who was ruling over vast territories, opulent kingdom, but he was at heart a master yogi. He ruled the kingdom, but he had also conquered the kingdom of within himself. Once it is said that when he was sitting, listening to the words of wisdom of some of the sages who had gathered, a messenger rushed in, saying that the capital is on fire. The king would not stir. He would not look at him. He repeated it once, twice. Looking at his importunity, the king turned round and said, even if the whole of Mithila, that is the capital, were burnt, nothing of me could be singed. It was at the court of such a king, such a sage king, that there was another sage. He was not a king, but he was the master of kings. Yajnavalkya is his name. One day, so the story goes, he decided to give up his possessions and retire to the forest. He was a self-realized man, but in keeping with the mores of those days, he had two wives, and before retiring he wanted to distribute his kingdom, his possessions equally between the two wives, and he called his first wife and said, I have decided to retire, I will give you half my possessions. Gargi, that's the name of the wife, first wife, she said, will the wealth that you give me assure me immortality? He said, certainly not. It will give you all that wealth can give, but nothing of immortality. Then what shall I do with the wealth that you are going to give me? Instruct me in that which will give me immortality. Instruct me in the knowledge that will give me the truth. I do not care for your wealth. The sage was very much pleased and said, give me your ear. I am very pleased that you have spoken what you have. And he starts a discourse emphasizing on the uniqueness, on the truth of the self, the divine self, which is the sole truth in the universe. He said, life is dear, not because of life, but because of the self that manifests in life. The husband is dear, not because of the husband, but because of the self. The wife is dear to one, not because of the wife, but because of the self. Now this important statement has been perverted, misinterpreted by commentators, and they have proceeded to give one meaning, saying that one doesn't really love one's wife because of her, but for one's own egoistic purpose. Well, that may be true at a certain level of life with certain individuals, or as a general rule, where the ego predominates. Wife is dear for the sake of the lower self. But it is also true, and more true, that the wife is dear to the husband, not because she is his wife. He is not dear to her because he is her husband, but because the self that is here, the central being, the divine being that is here, is also there. The self in me recognizes the same self that is in another body, in another embodiment. There is a flow from one self in one form to the same self in another. There is a natural attraction because there is this interchange behind the surface. So one is dear because of that self. When one sacrifices, it is to the one self that is in me, the sacrificer, the self in the person, the adored one, to whom the sacrifice is made. This doctrine of sacrifice was, as you know, made the central truth of life of the ancient mystics in the Veda. All the rishis of the Veda were great mystics whose first concern was spiritual. Not the spiritual as divorced from the temporal and the secular, but as the high point, as the sustaining base of all that is in the universe. The rishis had sacrifice as the main institution around which they organized their individual and their collective spiritual life. They speak of the altar on which the fire is burnt. Necessarily, they have to speak in images of the human language, devised by human language. But the truth, as Sri Aurobindo has perceived and pointed out, is that the altar is the heart, is the inner being, the purified chalice of the heart. The fire that burns is the flame of aspiration. One aspires intensely, putting all that one has into that intensity, and the flame shoots up, calling the divine powers to come. He gives, when it is imaged, his giving is imaged in the figures of cows, horses, wealth. It really means he gives whatever knowledge he has, whatever power he has acquired, whatever occult powers he has gained, he sacrifices to the divine. Agni, the flame power, central being, to render the mystic flame active, the rishis had received the potent word. They are the mantras which, when properly intoned, they released certain vibrations in the physical and in the subtle atmosphere, which invoked the presence of the gods. They are the mantras. Long before the ashram was formed, when Sri Aurobindo was explaining the Veda to the mother has recorded somewhere that as he recited one hymn, the very first hymn to Agni, the mystic flame, she saw the mystic flame present concretely, actually before her. That is the potency of the word. As the rishi aspires, invokes, gives himself inwardly to the gods, the first god to appear is Indra, the god of the divine mind. Man is a mental being, and when one catches that fire of self-giving, it is the mind levels that first open to the higher light and get illumined. Indra manifests. Indra manifests with his host of Maruts, the storm gods, which are the thought powers yoked to life. They get purified, link up man's life energies to the illumined mind. Next to appear is Varuna, the god of vastness. He is the lord of the vast infinite. The being expands, breaks through the walls of its ego. As said in the Savitri, the island ego joins its continent. Once the being spreads out in the vastitude of Varuna, there comes Mitra, the god of love. This is a welling out of a universal love, a love transcendent, which breaks across the individual barriers, goes to the very root of creation and manifests the divine love through the individual embodiment. And there are many more gods, but it is not our purpose today to dwell further on this topic. Suffice it to say that from the very beginning of the spiritual development of humanity, sacrifice has been chosen as the one capital means of breaking out of the limits of humanity and linking oneself with the higher existence. And in the integral yoga, in the yoga of works with which we are concerned at the moment, sacrifice, the principle of self-surrender, self-consecration, plays an important part. Without that, work ceases to be sadhana. Work becomes labor. It has no spiritual significance, no yogic meaning, unless every bit of work that we do is impelled on the surge of this feeling of self-surrender. One works for the divine, one offers the work for the divine. As this spirit of sacrifice develops, one realizes how silly the popular notions of sacrifice are. Sacrifice means to the common man an increasing degree of self-immolation, self-hurt, self-denial. Actually, what is denied is indulgence to the enemy. What is extirpated is the ego. What is released is the soul, is the divinity within. In the Gita, there is a significant chapter or a passage on this subject of sacrifice, in which man hurts himself, he imposes hardships, severities of food, denial, and punishes oneself. Krishna describes this kind of sacrifice as asuric, It is an offense against the indweller. It is a chastisement. It is a punishment of the Lord who is seated within. Instead of that, man is called upon to awaken his gentler faculties, his gentler emotions, summon up all his powers of devotion, love, and then surrender, then sacrifice, step by step. The Lord steps forth and receives the sacrifice acceptable. This spirit of sacrifice is to be present not only when one works, but Sri Aurobindo demands through all the hours of life, of the day. Even when one eats the simplest food, one has to be aware that the food is being consumed by the divine within oneself. It has to be accepted with gratitude from the donor, from one who serves the food, and offered to the divine within in a spirit of sacredness. So taken, so consumed, the material food, even the material food, bears its own nourishment to the spiritual well-being. There is an interchange even at the physical ordinary level. The ancients carried this one step further, and they had a discipline by which even the act of breathing was converted by a mantra into a beating of the universal heart of God. The in-breathing and the out-breathing, each step was identified. I am he, he is I. The perception was a living perception. Each moment there was an identification with the divine, universal divine. I am he, he is I. This constant affirmation underneath the surface, in the very act of breathing, made the presence so vivid, so concrete, that it left its impress on all the activities of life. Sacrifice, so conceived, so offered, so conducted, has three results. In the first place, one can't do this sacrifice in a spirit of detachment unless one puts all one's feeling, sincerity, emotion. One can't really sacrifice to the gods, to the divine. Devotion melts into feeling. Feeling deepens into love. The love regards the divine presence everywhere. In every occasion, in every moment, one feels the throb of the divine, and it is a joy to consecrate oneself, to offer oneself, what one does and what one has, to the divine. Second, one is always conscious of the liberating knowledge that there is nothing except the divine. All that you see is in the divine. The divine is in all, and the all is divine. This triple truth, this triple knowledge, is a natural truth idea vibrating in the mind of the seeker of the integral yoga who sacrifices to the Lord. Third, the human will for action, will for aggrandizement, gain, it is yoked to a higher purpose of the soul. The very character of the will, the element of self, the element of selfishness in the will, gets slowly dissolved from the personality, and the inner will comes forward, replaces the egoistic will, and that inner will is nothing but the channel of the diviner will. There is a meeting of all the three lines of yoga, the yoga of love, the yoga of knowledge, the yoga of will, in this path which proceeds upon a wholehearted, an illumined and a loving consecration of oneself, what one thinks, what one does, what one hopes and what one aspires to the divine. Any questions?
Will there be ever an end to sacrificing for the aspiring soul? It seems to me that it will continue and continue.
After a certain stage, sacrifice ceases to be sacrifice. It is a happy interchange. It is a fusing of one into another. That's the acme of sacrifice. And to the delight of fusion, of union, there is no foreseeable end. The end of union is only in ignorance. In knowledge, in light, there is no end to anything.
How does one distinguish between the offering and the sacrifice? Are they the same?
Offering is at the level of intention. The physical act of offering may be there, but there is an intention to give. But how far the intention is pure, how far the intention is translated, or whether it is a mechanical giving of an object or something, thought or an idea, it depends. Offering, when it matures into spiritual quality, that becomes the right sacrifice. It is like surrender. You have the intention to surrender. But merely by deciding to surrender, one doesn't surrender. One needs a whole lifetime to work out the discipline of surrender. So even sacrifice, it is a gradual, progressive discipline. But after a certain stage, it forges its own way. One doesn't have to exert oneself. One sacrifices as normally, as effortlessly as one breathes. Offering is the approach. The sacrifice is the fruit.
To offer all our weaknesses and defects as well?
Naturally, the very act of sacrifice presupposes that all that you have is offered, but sincerely. Once you offer your weakness to the divine, it is expected that you follow it up by doing what the divine expects of you. One has weakness, but in the very act of giving it, of making it over to the divine, one gets the strength to get over it. There are weaknesses which it is beyond human strength to overcome. They are best offered to the divine in the presence of the teacher or directly, and the necessary strength is obtained to overcome the weaknesses. Once a weakness is sincerely offered and surrendered, its roots are gone. There may be a mechanical indulgence in that weakness for a while, but it loses its sap if the offering has been sincere.
There's an increasing need in our part to a recognition of the Matramandir area as a consecrated area. It's the place where the temple of the mother is being built. And part of that movement is the offering of the weaknesses of tobacco smoking or any kind of smoking, sex indulgence. What would you consider the importance and a way of helping a collective effort in this direction as a sacrifice?
An aspiration, a sincere aspiration that these atavistic elements must go from the atmosphere. A sincere prayer to help the others to get rid of these, and in the flame that is slowly building itself in Matramandir, all these weaknesses will be consumed to ashes. There is no doubt about it. In the very act of working, in the very act of serving, one releases certain forces, spiritual and occult, which will relegate these drawbacks to the background, and they will just drop out. It is always good, profitable to emphasize on the positive side of things, not to look too much on the negative. As the positive gains gather, they just displace the negative ones, and cases are so many in which they just get dropped. If, as a result of certain karmic impressions or insincerity, fundamental insincerity, the things continue, the person drops out. Now I think we can conclude with the usual, I won't say anecdote, but something that happened last week. It was a visitor from Kashmir. He's in the services. He came with his wife. She was sitting. And he told me, for 13 years this woman has been possessed by a spirit. And she is harassing us. I asked him, what does the spirit do? He said, when this woman is possessed, she bangs her wrists, bangs the floor, the tables, and when my children are praying to the mother, and Sri Aurobindo says, ask your divine mother to remove me from here. And for 13 years she has been making a hell of us. All the while that lady was looking at me with great curiosity, in which her face is very clear. So he said, yes. He took her to the studio, had a picture taken, and gave the picture to me next morning. That day was a day when I could do some work with mother, because you know there are certain days when we can't do work with mother. They are the bulletin work days, Wednesdays and Saturdays. This I am telling for the information of friends. Wednesdays and Saturdays we are not expected to do any work with mother. Now that happened to be Thursday or a Friday, so I took it. And I showed to mother, this is the person and this is the history, and they are praying, mother said. Mother looked, she looked, and then suddenly closed her eyes. As she closed a little more than normal for her, with a little concentration, and then she suddenly opened. She said, something interesting. Then I looked up. She said, Sri Aurobindo told that spirit, now, depart or get converted. She repeated it. Then, as a gesture and a confirmation, she wrote on the back of the photograph, blessings, gave a special packet of her blessings. And then, I have given it to the lady, but I do not know. There is no doubt about it. Once Sri Aurobindo has said, or mother has said, to the spirit you go, it has to go. But if when the spirit departs, naturally the spirit is not going to get converted so easily. It will rather depart from one human being and take possession of another, rather than, you see, get converted. So the first thing it will do is to leave. But if this lady calls it back, then everybody is helpless. This is what has been happening 90% of the cases that we have seen. Persons are possessed, persons get involved in certain other such cases, they come to mother. Mother says it's very easy for her. She has just to do like this and they go, either from a house or a human being. But she says, suddenly these people feel empty. That vital feeling is there, is not there. So they feel empty and they wish something is missing, something is missing. And they think perhaps it is good to have it. That comes back. She says thrice she has driven out the spirit. But each time, now whether it is a spirit of a ghost or a spirit of madness, lunacy, or any kind, 3-4 times she has removed. But each time when the person brought it back, by subconscious wish maybe, she is helpless and she has to leave them. So here I am awaiting to hear from the gentleman what has happened. 13 years of habit is not a joke. She is a very unlettered person, she does not understand many things. So this, I thought I should say, one, because of the light it throws on the way of working of mother and Sri Aurobindo, and also a question was asked some time back whether Sri Aurobindo is present here amidst us. He is physically, almost physically present. As mother was seeing, he told the spirit. It was only last week. So this is something for you all to think about. So do we move to the Matra Mandir now?